The Honorable, the Chief Justice, and the Associate Justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. Oyez, 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 all persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of the United States, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Justice Gorsuch has the opinion of the court in two cases this morning.
The first one is the state of Ohio versus the Environmental Protection Agency. Under the Clean Air Act, the Environmental Protection Agency sets air quality standards. Once the agency sets a new standard, however, individual states are entitled to draft their own plans implementing that standard in their jurisdictions. If a state's plan meets the Act's requirements, EPA must approve it. If not, EPA may create a substitute federal plan of its own for that state. Here, EPA recently set a new standard concerning ozone levels. Many states responded by submitting plans for meeting that new standard. Ultimately, however, EPA announced its intention to reject over 20 of those state plans and replace them with its own federal plan. As EPA described its proposed federal plan, it sought to identify a set of emissions control measures that would maximize cost-effective improvements in ozone levels. In its proposed plan, however, the agency proceeded on a key assumption, namely that its plan would apply to all of the 20-plus states whose state plans the agency had rejected. EPA then published its proposed federal plan for notice and comment. During that period, some raised a concern. They warned that the federal plan might not turn out to cover all 20-plus states, as the agency anticipated. As commenters saw it, some of the agency's rulings rejecting the state plans were themselves legally flawed and likely to be enjoined. In other words, some states were likely to drop out of the proposed federal plan. And that, commenters warned, might require EPA to go back to the drawing board on its own federal plan. That is because as the mix of states in the federal plan changes, each with its own unique mix of industries, so might the mix of emissions control measures that maximize cost-effective ozone air quality improvements. After the public comment period, EPA finalized its federal plan. But in doing so, it did not address the thrust of the commenters' concerns. Yet, as it turned out, at least some of those concerns began to materialize. Courts across the country began enjoining EPA's decisions rejecting the state plans, finding that the agency's decisions were likely unlawful. And that meant that the agency could not apply its federal plan to those states. All that, in turn, led some of the states remaining in the federal plan to challenge it as arbitrary and capricious and therefore unenforceable under the Clean Air Act's terms. Once more, these states argued that EPA had failed to address whether the measures it proposed in its federal plan, measures premised on the participation of all 20-plus states, remained cost-effective at improving air quality when the plan now turned out to cover many fewer states. Pursuant to the Clean Air Act II, these states sought a stay of the federal plan while their legal challenge could play out. After the D.C. Circuit denied that request, the states renewed it here. As might be obvious by now, this complex case does not lend itself to easy oral explanation. Suffice it to say that the court received extensive briefing, reviewed a voluminous record, and held a lengthy oral argument. And for reasons explored in the opinion we filed with the clerk today, we agree that the Clean Air Act entitles the applicants to a stay of the federal plan while their litigation unfolds. Justice Barrett has filed a dissenting opinion in which Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson have joined. All right, second case, Harrington versus Purdue Pharma. Between 1999 and 2019, approximately a quarter of a million people in the United States died from prescription opioid overdoses. The federal government estimates that the opioid epidemic has cost this country between $53 and $72 billion annually. This case involves Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family. For years, Purdue aggressively marketed OxyContin, an opioid pain reliever. The company claimed its drug was less addictive and less subject to abuse than other medications. The Sackler family owned and controlled Purdue and oversaw the firm's marketing strategies. Eventually, those strategies came under scrutiny. In 2007, a Purdue affiliate pleaded guilty to a federal felony for misleadingly marketing OxyContin as less addictive than it really was. That guilty plea triggered thousands of civil lawsuits as individuals, families, and governments sought damages from both Purdue and the Sacklers for injuries allegedly caused by their deceptive marketing practices. In response to this litigation, the Sacklers devised what they described as a milking program to drain Purdue of its assets and divert its funds overseas to trusts and other entities owned by the family. Between 2008 and 2016, the Sacklers distributed approximately $11 billion of Purdue's revenue to themselves, leaving the company in a significantly weakened financial state. And in 2019, the company filed for bankruptcy. In Purdue's bankruptcy, the Sacklers saw, as they put it, an opportunity to get their own goals accomplished. Specifically, they proposed to return to Purdue's bankruptcy estate around 4.3 of the $11 billion they had withdrawn. But they agreed to do so only if Purdue would include in its bankruptcy plan a special provision for them, one that would extinguish forever any suits against members of the Sackler family by opioid victims, even claims for wrongful death and fraud, and all without the consent of the victims themselves. Purdue agreed to include this provision in its bankruptcy plan, and ultimately a divided panel of the Second Circuit approved that move. The U.S. trustee responsible for overseeing the administration of federal bankruptcies asked us to review the decision. He stressed that there exists a long-standing split among federal courts of appeals over whether bankruptcy courts enjoy the power to extinguish claims by non-debtors like the Sackler, extinguish claims by non-debtors like the victims against other non-debtors like the Sacklers. We agreed to take up the case to resolve that split of authority. And in brief, here is what we decide. Under federal law, bankruptcy courts have many and extensive powers when it comes to adjusting the rights and duties of those in bankruptcy. When a debtor comes forward and puts all of its assets on the table for its creditors, a bankruptcy court may extinguish many existing claims against the debtor, often in order to allow the debtor to make a fresh start. Here, that means the court was free to extinguish claims against Purdue itself. At the same time, however, the bankruptcy code's focus is squarely on the debtor. Nothing in it permits a court to wipe the slate clean for others outside the bankruptcy, like the Sacklers, who have not come forward with all of their assets for their creditors. Nor does the bankruptcy code permit a court, even when it comes to debtors in bankruptcy, to extinguish claims for wrongful death and fraud, as the Sacklers seek here. Put another way, in this case, the Sacklers ask for more relief than a bankruptcy court may provide even a debtor who actually declares bankruptcy. And the Sacklers seek that relief all while putting on the table far less than their full assets as a debtor in bankruptcy must. In short, we agree with U.S. trustee. The bankruptcy code focuses on the debtor's rights and liabilities. Nothing in it permits a court to extinguish claims against non-debtors like the Sacklers that belong to other non-debtors like the victims, all without their consent. Because the Second Circuit held otherwise, its judgment is reversed, and the case is remanded for further proceedings consistent with our opinion. Justice Kavanaugh has filed a dissenting opinion in which the Chief Justice, Justice Sotomayor, and Justice Kagan have joined.
I have the opinion of the court this morning in case 22-859, Securities and Exchange Commission versus Jarkissi. In the aftermath of the Wall Street crash of 1929, Congress passed three laws designed to combat securities fraud: the Securities Act of 1933, the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, and the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. Although each of these laws regulate different aspects of the securities markets, their pertinent provisions, referred to by the regulators as the anti-fraud provisions, target the same basic behavior, misrepresenting or concealing material facts. Now, one way the SEC can enforce these provisions is by bringing an action seeking civil penalties. Until 2010, it could only do that in federal court before a judge with a jury. In 2010, however, Congress passed the Dodd-Frank Act, which allowed the SEC to seek civil penalties in-house before one of its administrative law judges and with its Division of Enforcement prosecuting the action. That's what it did in this case, bringing an action against George Jarkissi and his firm for fraud. The commission won an award of $300,000, but Jarkissi argued that the award should be thrown out on the ground that it violated his right under the Seventh Amendment to a jury trial. The lower court agreed, and we granted review. The Seventh Amendment provides that, quote, in suits at common law, where the value in controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved. The question is whether the SEC's civil penalty action counts as a suit at common law. Now, we held long ago that the proceeding doesn't have to be one of the old Latin causes of action to qualify, but it has to sufficiently resemble such an action, and it has to seek a common law remedy. Here, the first part of that inquiry is pretty easy. It was well established at common law that you could bring an action for fraud, and what's before us is an SEC action for fraud. Now, when it comes to the remedy, that part is pretty easy, too. Only common law courts could award monetary remedies to punish or deter culpable individuals, and that is exactly what the civil penalties do in this case. So Mr. Jarkissi should win, and the penalty action against him should be thrown out. Not so fast, says the government. It points out that there is an exception to the Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial called the public rights exception. And under that exception, no jury is required when a case concerns certain special governmental prerogatives, like collecting taxes, awarding patent rights or government pensions, interacting with the Indian tribes, allowing people and goods into the country at the border. Now, none of these sound particularly like the civil penalty action against Mr. Jarkissi. But the government says there's the Atlas Roofing case, which was decided by this court in 1977. It involved the Occupational Safety and Health Act, under which the government could set safety rules for construction and get civil penalties for violations. And this court ruled that there was no right to a jury trial when the government sought to collect those penalties. But when you read the opinion, you see why, and why Atlas Roofing does not apply here. Remember, we said that the test for whether the Seventh Amendment applied was whether the cause of action resembled one at common law and whether the remedy was one available at common law. The Atlas Roofing Court recognized that and said that the OSHA proceeding before it involved, quote, a new cause of action and remedies, therefore, unknown to the common law. So that case does not apply here, and Mr. Jarkissi is correct that he had a right to a jury trial before a judge. A right so important that the colonists listed British efforts to take it away as one of the reasons they were declaring independence and taking up arms 248 years ago next week. The judgment of the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit is affirmed, and the case is remanded for further proceedings consistent with this opinion. Justice Gorsuch has filed a concurrence, which Justice Thomas has joined. Justice Sotomayor has filed a dissent, which Justice Kagan and Justice Jackson joined.
This case involves the interplay of two constitutional provisions. One is the Seventh Amendment, which, as you heard, preserves the right of a jury by trial in suits at common law where the value in controversy shall exceed $20. That means a defendant is entitled to a jury if the claim at issue is brought in court and is legal in nature. Some examples include a common law fraud action for damages, or a claim of fraudulent conveyance or fraudulent transfer of property. The other provision at issue is Article III's vesting clause, which provides that the, quote, judicial power of the United States shall be vested, close quote, in federal Article III courts. Ordinarily, Congress passes a statute and authorizes someone to file a lawsuit in federal court to enforce a particular statutory obligation. One example might be Title VII's prohibition against different kinds of discrimination in the workplace. Then there are certain rights called public rights that the Constitution does not require to be heard by a jury in federal court. Congress can assign the initial enforcement of those rights to an agency for an executive official to find the facts, apply the law to the facts, and determine the appropriate penalty for a violation of statute. The precise definition of what qualifies as a public right has been the source of debate in this court's precedents, particularly in cases involving private disputes. But one thing that has remained undisputed and repeatedly stated in over a century of precedents is that a public right includes rights belonging to the government in its sovereign capacity. To quote Justice Scalia, public rights refer to rights pertaining to claims brought or against the United States. Because the Constitution permits Congress to assign public rights to agencies for initial adjudication, the key question in this kind of case is whether a public right is at issue. Today's decision runs contrary to settled government practice and long-standing precedent. Throughout our nation's history, Congress has authorized agency officials to adjudicate violations of statutory obligations and award civil penalties to the government. This court, in turn, has repeatedly declared that practice to be constitutional. The last time this court upheld this kind of scheme was approximately half a century ago in the case called Atlas Roofing. There, the court unanimously held that Congress could authorize the government to bring civil penalty claims in agency enforcement actions under the Occupational Safety and Health Act. Unsurprisingly, Congress has taken this court's word at face value. It has enacted hundreds of statutes authorizing countless federal agencies to impose civil penalties for violations of statutory obligation. This means, for example, that if an employer maintains unsafe working conditions or engages in unfair labor practices, including something that might cause the death of a person, government agencies can bring enforcement actions against the employer and impose civil penalties for those statutory violations, which the employer can then ask a court to review. This is despite there being common law remedies for the injured party to pursue in court and before a jury. Or here, the Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC, can initiate an enforcement proceeding and impose civil penalties, subject to judicial review, against someone who defrauds investors in violation of federal securities law. And those individuals can bring their own suits in court. Today, for the first time in our history, this court holds that these kinds of statutory schemes are unconstitutional. According to today's majority, the Constitution requires the government to seek civil penalties for federal securities fraud in front of a jury in federal court. The majority says that the nature of the remedy, that it involves civil penalties, resolves this case. But we know that is wrong from the more than a century of precedent to the contrary, including Atlas Roofing. Not one of the cases relied upon by the majority involves the agency adjudication of civil penalty claims brought by the government in its sovereign capacity. The majority also says that federal securities fraud looks similar to common law fraud, or similar enough, for which a jury is constitutionally required. That alternative explanation fares no better. Common law fraud is materially different from federal securities law. We have said that in a dozen or more cases. Common law fraud requires a showing of reliance on a defendant's misrepresentations, as well as proof of actionable injury. This is not true for a federal securities claim. Unlike the common law, federal securities claims belong to the government in its sovereign capacity and not to any particular individual. Securities laws are meant to protect not the individual investor, but to protect the integrity of the securities market and vindicate harms to the public at large. A faithful and straightforward application of this court's precedents should have resolved today's case. Indeed, we expressly said in Atlantis Roofing that, quote, Congress may effectively supplant the common law cause of action, carrying with it a right to a jury trial, with a statutory cause of action shorn of a jury trial right, if that statutory cause of action inheres in or lies against the federal government in its sovereign capacity. Close quote. We could not have been any clearer. The majority today brushes aside this court's precedents in dealing with it and deals a devastating blow to the manner in which our government functions. Yet not once in the majority's opinion will you see the words stare decisis, nor will you see any acknowledgement of the hundreds of federal statutes that are now in peril, or of the numerous agencies that may be stripped of their power to enforce statutes Congress has enacted. In fact, many agencies likely will lose their ability to enforce federal statutes because they can only impose civil penalties in administrative proceedings. To those agencies, the majority says, tough luck. Get a new statute from Congress. By giving respondents a jury trial in federal court, even one that the Constitution does not require, the majority may think that it is protecting liberty. But do not mistake judicial hubris with the protection of individual rights. In reality, the majority has taken power that belongs to Congress by prohibiting Congress from assigning to the executive for initial adjudication claims that are sovereign in nature. Litigants seeking further dismantling of the administrative state have reason to rejoice in their win today. But those of us who cherish the rule of law have nothing to celebrate. Because this court fails to act as a neutral empire when it rewrites established rules in the manner it does today, and because it disregards the co-equal partners in our system of government, I, with Justice Kagan and Jackson, respectfully dissent.
In case 23-726, Moyle versus United States, and 23-727, Idaho versus United States, the court is issuing a per curiam ruling, which I will announce. The writs of certiorari before judgment are dismissed as improvidently granted, and the stays entered by the court on January 5, 2024, are vacated. Justice Kagan filed a concurrence, which Justice Sotomayor joined in full, and Justice Jackson joined as to part two. Justice Barrett filed a concurrence joined by myself and Justice Kavanaugh. Justice Jackson has written an opinion concurring in part and dissenting in part. Justice Alito has filed a dissent, which Justice Thomas joined in full, and Justice Gorsuch joined as to parts one and two.
While I agree with the court's decision to lift the stay that it previously issued in this case, I do not agree that this matter should be dismissed as improvidently granted. There is a conflict here between the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, known as EMTALA, and Idaho state law. In a nutshell, EMTALA requires hospitals to provide stabilizing treatment for patients experiencing medical emergencies. There are certain circumstances in which an abortion is the only way to stabilize a patient. So, in those circumstances, the only way to comply with federal law is to provide that treatment. But Idaho state law prohibits abortions unless they are necessary to prevent a patient's death. No one disputes that this conflict between state and federal law is a narrow one. But for those it affects, it is very significant. At bottom, the conflict is about whether a pregnant patient at risk of losing her uterus or going into organ failure or suffering any other kind of serious but not life-threatening risk to her health or future fertility is entitled to emergency medical treatment. The federal government mandates such treatment, while Idaho prohibits it if it involves providing an abortion. Therefore, under the Supremacy Clause of our Constitution, Idaho's law must yield. 5 months ago, after a district court preliminarily enjoined Idaho's law on that basis, this court intervened. We stayed the district court's injunction, allowing Idaho to enforce its law, despite the clear conflict with EMTALA. At the same time, we granted certiorari before judgment, moving this matter onto our merits docket. And today, we lift the stay and dismiss the matter from our docket without pronouncing any judgment. In my view, this court should have taken this opportunity to make a clear pronouncement regarding federal preemption. We granted cert and heard argument. We have had ample time to consider the issues. The parties were well represented on both sides, and dozens of amici have weighed in. There is nothing about the core conflict in this case that has materially changed or shifted since we granted cert. And the court should have ruled in order to clear up any uncertainty that remains about whether pregnant patients experiencing emergency medical conditions in Idaho can have those conditions treated consistent with the standard of care. Not doing anything is problematic for several reasons, including that we have already seen the fallout from Idaho's interference with the federal mandate. The threat of prosecution under Idaho's law for providing an abortion to a patient experiencing an emergency medical condition has led to a dramatic increase in the transfer of pregnant patients in distress to medical facilities in other states, which is precisely the harm that EMTALA was enacted to prevent. Instead of viewing today's dismissal as a victory for pregnant patients in Idaho, I see it as a harmful delay. No, this court has not adopted Idaho's far-fetched theories about how its law can coexist with EMTALA, but the court has not rejected Idaho's arguments either. Meanwhile, as this court dawdles and the country waits, pregnant people in emergency situations in that state and elsewhere are paying the price, because their doctors have been kept in the dark about what the law actually requires. This court had a chance to bring clarity and certainty to this tragic situation, and we have squandered it. We owe pregnant patients and their doctors the answer to the straightforward preemption question presented in this case. I respectfully dissent to the dismissal of this matter because we should have provided that answer today.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.